at The Letters, Sportsnet's Blue Jays podcast with Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith.
It's at The Letters for Wednesday, February the 3rd in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Please like, share, favorite, and subscribe. My name is Arden Zwelling. I'm a staff writer here at Sportsnet. I'm joined, as always, by my colleague, baseball editor, Sportsnet.ca, Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, what's going on?
Not too much. Baseball is back this month. Spring training begins in, what, a few weeks?
You know when spring training, as if you don't know.
February 21st.
When does it begin? You know exactly when. Here's the thing, is that the beginning of spring training is like, it's nice. And it's like a step, and you see on Twitter people being like, oh, X number of days till spring training, like this many hours or this many seconds. It's really just the beginning of six more weeks of waiting. Really.
And while we wait, we have been discussing quite the Jose Bautista situation, and you've been really at the center of it. Ken Rosenthal was here at a Pitch Talks event on Friday, and we were talking with Ken and with a great audience at 918 Bathurst about Jose Bautista's contract situation. That thing really took off. You've really been getting quite a few Twitter mentions in the last little bit.
One or two. People are pretty desperate for something to talk about right now. They're scraping the bottom of the barrel, and when you scrape that barrel bottom, you find me. You find that I am there.
So were you surprised by how much it took off?
I was a little surprised just because it's an opinion that I've shared like before. I'm pretty sure on this podcast a few times, on Blair's show, certainly at a Pitch Talks like 48 hours before that Pitch Talks with like way more people in the audience. So it's like it is interesting. It speaks a bit to the power of Ken Rosenthal that he can just kind of decide, hey, this is going to be a topic of national discussion for a week. So that's been interesting. Like, I won't lie. Like, I'll be pretty happy when it's over. Like, I'll be pretty happy to go back to like obscurity and not have to deal with people, you know, calling me a hack and calling me a fanboy and calling me a Rogers apologist. Even though, like, how can I be a Rogers apologist by saying they should spend money on Jose Bautista, when if I said they shouldn't spend money on Jose Bautista, I would also be, you know, like, you can't win.
You can't win.
You can't win.
But before this whole storm dies away, we're gonna stay in it for a little while. And I think before we talk to Ken Rosenthal about this whole thing and get his opinions on it, let's lay the land for everyone who might not have been there and who might not have heard about it. So Jose Bautista, free agent after this season, phenomenal player, an icon in Blue Jays history. And now the Blue Jays have to decide whether to make him an extension offer, which I assume they will, and how much that will be for. So how much should they be prepared to offer a player who is aging and yet so impressive offensively?
Well, so I think it starts at kind of 4 years, $100 million. I would say that's where kind of the discussion starts. And I think that, you know, Jose Bautista's agent will probably want you to go to 5 years. So maybe now you get into the $125 million range. Maybe you can, you know, play with it with deferrals and you can, you know, play around with options and things like that, or incentives are out, whatever you have to do to kind of make the immediate financial burden less so. But I think that's kind of the realm that, you know, that's the ballpark that you're playing in. I think the Blue Jays should absolutely play in it. And I think the Blue Jays should absolutely extend Jose Bautista for what it's going to cost, for fair market value. When I say that they should, you know, ask him what he wants and give it to him, you know, I don't mean that if he asks for $200 million, they should give it to him. But if he asks for something reasonable in terms of, you know, today's baseball market, all the money in the game, what Chris Davis is getting and other hitters are getting and you know, what he could get on the free agent market at the end of the year, if he asks for something reasonable, I think the Blue Jays should give it to him.
So a five-year deal for Bautista would keep him in Toronto or wherever he's playing through age 40. That's an age that Miguel Cabrera is signed through, Robinson Cano is signed through, Beltran and Votto, those guys are signed through age 39. So that's not crazy. And if you're trying to talk how much he would make per year, then you look at guys like Chris Davis, Justin Upton, Cespedes, $23 million per year. Bautista, a better player than all three of those guys right now. Mm-hmm. Now, does he stay a better player? He's entering his decline phase. I think that much is safe to assume. Players just don't get better after the age of 35. It doesn't happen. So if you're looking at a five-year deal, potentially $23 million, that gets you to $115 million. That could be the range. And this is complete speculation. I could be off. I could be way high, I could be way low. But if that's somewhat of the ballpark that you're talking in, is that a number you'd be comfortable with from the perspective of the team?
Absolutely. And I don't think that Jose Bautista is going to hit like a $23 million a year player when he's 39 and 40. Maybe he will, but I mean, you know, generally players don't hit that well, at that age. But, you know, I think that as the Toronto Blue Jays, I mean, you have to kind of figure out how you value things past the numbers and past the analytics. This is what's been, I speak about just being a little bit frustrated with this debate is that, you know, so many people will come at you and say, oh, you know, it's all numbers. Like, it's got to be all this. You can only look at it through this prism. Not true. Not true at all. You absolutely have to factor in what Jose Bautista has done for this franchise, how you value the fact that he is, you know, basically second to Carlos Delgado in terms of, you know, production as a Blue Jay all time. When you look at OPS, home runs, walks, it's those two guys up there. When you value the fact this guy has been, you know, really the emotional center of this team for a number of years, when you look at, you know, everything that's happened on the field, and it really kind of came to a crescendo last year in the playoffs with, you know, the ALDS Game 5 home run, and then the home run everyone forgot off Ryan Madsen in ALCS Game 6 that, you know, that almost, you know, took the Blue Jays to, you know, put them in a position to get to a Game 7 there. When you look at his clubhouse influence on young players, which is profound, when you look at his role as an ambassador for Latin American players, when you look at the money that you can make off of him, the profit, you know, the marketability of this guy, and, you know, of him kind of being an icon in Toronto in a lot of ways, how do you value those things? And does that kind of make up the difference for you that you might see when his production inevitably drops off later in his years?
And yet there is a line. There is a line for any player that you're just not going to pay him if he's looking for a certain amount of money. And that applies to everyone from a minor league signing potentially to an elite player like Jose Bautista. It certainly applied in the case of David Price. Historically, Mark Shapiro and the Indians had to be very disciplined, and really every team. Hey, look at the Yankees, look at the Angels. There are a lot of teams that are trying to stay under the luxury tax within their payroll. And so there is a line. And for me, I know that you're not saying give him exactly what he wants, yeah. but I think maybe some fans would. And there's a point where you have to say, you know what, this is too much. Best of luck, and we'll see you at Fenway Park. Because really, I mean, there is a line. And so as great a player as Jose Bautista is, if that greatness translates into a massive $200 million deal in free agency, I don't think you want to be the one stuck with that contract.
We'll see you just putting dents in that green monster for the next 5 years.
He'd be a great fit there. So would Edwin, by the way. Watch out. 2017 Red Sox.
But, you know, the thing with Jose and why I think that maybe you can make a pretty good case for him being productive into his late 30s is some of his attributes. And, you know, we're not talking about like the prototypical slugger, like the Ryan Howard, Adam Dunn, like massive lumbering body just waiting to break down kind of guy. Like, we're talking about really like a pretty average looking athlete, like not a guy who, you know, has a lot of parts that are going to break down. A guy who really takes care of himself in terms of nutrition, you know, flexibility, durability, the way he works out, very, you know, forward thinking when it comes to that kind of stuff. A guy whose best, honestly, I think his best skill is plate approach and pitch recognition, strike zone knowledge. Like, I think that's his best skill beyond the raw power. Is, go ahead.
Right, I would say power is his best skill.
No, I think I take that over his power, really, is being able to walk as much as he does, being able to get to his pitch so that he can hit it out of the ballpark. He gets to his pitch is the thing when you look at the at-bats that he takes. And, you know, when you look at the breaking balls he lays off, I mean, tough, tough pitches that he really lays off. And, you know, I think that umpires oftentimes don't give him enough benefit of the doubt. He has a great understanding of the strike zone. So I think those are, at least we can debate about whether that's, which is a better skill, but him having those attributes, those project well into your late 30s and early 40s. He's also a guy who doesn't sell out for power. Like, if he gets that inside pitch, like, absolutely he's going to try to yank it into the left field seats. But if he gets into a pitcher's count, the pitcher gives him a good pitch on the outer half, he's going to try to shoot it the right, you know, to the right side. How many times have we seen him do that? He doesn't really, you know, he doesn't sell out for power at all. So I think that, you know, those are skills that project well into, you know, a long-term contract for Jose Bautista.
They do. And yet any team that's signing a player, a power hitter deep into his 30s, has to be aware of the fact that the Jim Tomies of the world are the exception. And most of the time, age does factor in, and you do start to see a decline. So it all adds up to a very interesting discussion that we'll pick up with Ken Rosenthal.
Absolutely. A very interesting discussion that has raged on throughout this week and honestly is going to rage on throughout the season unless they do something, you know,
like play training. A game.
Yeah. But like, you know, unless they figure something out with them in spring training. I mean, this is and it's also the way it relates to Edwin Encarnacion. Because if you sign Jose Bautista for $23 million a year, you're probably not going to be able to re-sign Edwin.
And Encarnacion, on a performance level, has been every bit as good. I mean, these guys it's so easy to overlook how good they've been. They're incredible hitters. In an age where strikeouts are on the rise, they walk as much as they strike out. It's phenomenal, the production that they put up, and yet there is that question. How long does it stay at this level?
So we're going to pick this back up with Ken Rosenthal, who's going to be joining us on the other side of the break. I don't think I mentioned that off the top. I should have. But Ken Rosenthal is going to be on the podcast. He's going to join us after the break when we pick this up. And then after Ken, we are going to be joined by Drew Storen of your Toronto Blue Jays, one of the most recent additions to the Blue Jays. And we're going to talk to him about a variety of things, probably not Jose Bautista's contract.
You never know.
But we're going to talk to him about a lot of things. So Drew Storen will be coming up at the end of the podcast in the next segment. Ken Rosenthal talking about all of this Bautista stuff and about his column. And during the break, we're going to play a clip, or at least a portion of what set this all off at Pitch Talks last week. Which Ben so just loves to remind me of every day.
Hey, it's the topic of the day. You gotta embrace it.
So so all that and more coming up on At the Letters.
Doesn't seem like the rational, reasonable move for the Blue Jays to do or to make right now. But there's also a part of me that says, ask Jose Bautista what he wants and give it to him.
Yes!
If there was ever a player with the skill set that could last into his late 30s and potentially even early 40s, a guy who has a low amount of kilometers on his body because he really played for the first 10 years of his career, a guy who takes care of his body, does a lot of yoga, a lot of, you can laugh, but you can ask any athlete in his late 30s, early 40s, what keeps them going.
Testify!
It's flexibility, it's that durability. A guy who this year played through a significant shoulder injury, remained productive, a guy whose biggest skill and attribute as a baseball player is his plate vision and his discipline, his ability to recognize
balls
and strikes. When Jose Bautista says the pitch is a ball, it's a ball.
It continues on At the Letters, Arden Zwelling with Ben Nicholson-Smith on Sportsnet.ca and iTunes. Very pleased to be joined by Ken Rosenthal of Fox Sports, MLB Network, many places. You may recognize Ken from, being one of the biggest names in baseball sports media, but also from his column earlier this week about his experience in Toronto at a Pitch Talks event and, Jose Bautista and the effect of humanity and baseball, things like that. I mean, Ken, I just off the top, what's been kind of your thoughts on the reaction to the column and some of the discussion it's generated?
Well, actually, first of all, I have to thank Arden for the inspiration because otherwise it does not happen. The whole thing had not really occurred to me until I heard his awesome soliloquy at the Pitch Talks event. As for the reaction, I was sort of bracing for a strong pushback from the sabermetric community because they are quite eager to push back when they feel aggrieved. But it hasn't been like that at all. And actually, it's been mostly positive. And even Dave Cameron at Fangraphs, who is one of the leading sabermetric writers and a friend, but I thought, even as friends, we can disagree, and I thought he would be pretty anti what that column was. And he wrote a column yesterday on Fangraphs saying, you know what? I sort of get it. So, the column, for whatever reason, seemed to strike a chord with some people, a lot of people, and that's good. That's what you always aim to do. You want to make people think. I don't expect everyone to agree with it. And if somebody says to me, well, what exactly were you getting at? What were you suggesting? I can't really give a specific answer because I was more talking about an overall theme to what I'm seeing. But it's been interesting always to see how this debate breaks down and who has what opinions. But for the most part, this one, I've gotten a positive response, which in this day and age is kind of shocking.
It's definitely generated a lot of discussion online and on the radio, on TV. You're on MLB Network the other day. I'm wondering, have you heard from anyone in the game, some of these decision makers that we're talking about here? And has anyone reached out and offered their opinion one way or the other?
Yes, actually. And I heard from a couple of scouting types who basically said they liked it. But I also heard from one GM, and I won't mention his name. Maybe you can figure it out, maybe not. He's with a rebuilding team, and he says one of the problems that his team has faced is the idea of detaching the star players, the recognizable names, from the fan base, and understanding that the fans are attached to these players and don't want to see them go. That's kind of what we were talking about. That's kind of what Arden's message was. Hey, this is Bautista. He's the Blue Jays guy, and he should be their guy. And even in this day and age of numbers and payroll efficiency and all the things we talk about, obviously for some teams at least, not all, that emotional aspect, the fan attachment, comes into play.
I've got some theories on who that GM might be. I'll keep them to myself.
That's for your, yeah, you guys have fun with that. I'm not going to reveal it.
I feel like it's a National League guy.
They're all the rebuilding
guys. Right.
Fair enough. You mentioned the Dave Cameron's piece, and that was a really interesting and, I thought really thoughtful piece, and he made, some pretty, interesting, points, I guess, about, whether or not, efficient spending, like you were just saying, has to always be at odds with, emotional attachment to a player, or, with a, a player being a franchise guy. And, he brought up, Cal Ripken and Tony Gwynn. I mean, Derek Jeter's the obvious example. And I really feel like Jose Bautista can be that guy in Toronto. I'm not necessarily, and I agree with Dave, I don't think that these things always have to be at odds. I do think there's things that teams and ownership specifically can do to allow for, a team to still be successful and to retain, some of their most prized assets.
Well, Jay Jaffe, on that same MLB Network show that I was on the other day, pointed out that all these teams have money now, so what's the problem? And that was a really good point. And actually, Dave amplified that point in his column, basically saying, in this day and age, when you do have these kinds of payrolls, it can account for a little bit of what he called irrational humanity. And certainly signing Bautista or extending him, however they do it, I don't know that it would fall into the category of irrational necessarily, but the size of the deal might. And if you're the Blue Jays, I know, and we discussed this, and Ben made the great point about you can't really do something like this unless you raise payroll. But if you're the Blue Jays, you can raise payroll. And you can accommodate this. And there are certain tangible financial benefits, I am sure, to having a so-called franchise player like that. You can promote him. You can market him. He gives you that identification. So it's an interesting discussion. And again, none of us up there the other night, and I'm not advocating now, anything stupid, dumb, emotional signings. You don't give Bautista 6 years or $150 million right now. Nobody's saying you should do that. But this part of the game, the fan attachment and the feelings the fans have, my fear is that it's getting overlooked by certain GMs. And I get it. I totally understand what's going on. But at the same time, we're talking about baseball, not national defense for Canada or the United States. And there should be some, what I call it, humanity in there.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I think it's maybe the most important takeaway from all of this discussion is that there can be some room for that softer, you can't necessarily measure it, but it's something that does matter and does have an impact. But I guess my question for both of you guys is where you draw the line. You know, if you're the Tampa Bay Rays and you sign Evan Longoria to his first contract, which was extremely team friendly, then that's great. And his second contract for $100 million, that's still probably doable. But at a certain point, if you're the Tampa Bay Rays or if you're a small market team, you're going to have to draw the line. And even if you're the Blue Jays, every team has a budget, whether or not they could exceed that. They do have a budget. So where do you draw that line?
I'm not sure of the answer to that. And again, the column that I wrote, I know it was partly about Bautista and certainly what Arden said, but it was more about the whole thing. And I wasn't necessarily talking about any one player per se or any one team, any one concept. I was just talking about the fact that we're losing something with all this attention on the numbers all the time. And that bothers me. And the fact that people look at the game through this one prism now, certain people do, and don't account for the other elements, that bothers me. So where you draw the line, obviously, Ben, that's a great question, and it's a fair question. Teams can't spend unlimited amount of money. And I don't know what the answer is. I'm sure for each team it's different. But again, what I'm talking about is more of a general feel kind of thing. And again, I don't know the specific suggestion I would have. If a GM came to me, at one point I had in a column, I couldn't make it work, but I had in a column, I'm sure there are GMs who I know are analytically minded or sitting there thinking, okay, Ken, what do you suggest here? What exactly are you talking about? And my answer was, what I'm talking about is soul. Now, I didn't include that because I got into the humanity part. It just didn't work. You guys know it's right. Some things just don't work. But that is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the game having a soul. And now I'm fearing with some of the things I'm seeing that it's losing that a bit. And that's not cool.
Yeah, you know, it's an unanswerable question, Ben, because I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think as a franchise, you kind of have to sit down and figure out, all right, what do we value and what are our priorities and what, you know, how do we prioritize those things we look for in a player and as we build a team. And I think Ken makes a great point about how sometimes you look through at players through such a narrow prism of, you know, quantifying their results and numbers and, you know, exit velocities and bat speeds and things like this and trends, and the humanity of it gets lost. And there's, you know, you can't ignore the human element of baseball, and you can't ignore that the character, makeup, psyche, clubhouse stuff. I mean, this all matters, and how you have to figure out how you value that as a franchise. And I think that, you know, here in Toronto, we saw a great example with Alex Anthopoulos of a guy who really, you know, viewed things through an analytical prism early on in his tenure as a general manager, and then evolved over time and kind of said, you know what, I really need to start valuing character more, and I really need to start valuing loyalty and valuing, you know, guys who are going to get along together and things like that. You know, Jose Bautista obviously being one of those guys, and, you know, you can see through a lot of the moves that he made in the last, you know, I guess 12 to 36 months of his tenure, you know, just how that really inflected what he did and the moves that he made.
One thing
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to kind of wonder if it's easier for a team that's in a big market like the Blue Jays are to absorb that kind of risk and to take that emotional plunge and you say, you know what, it might not work out, but we're going to go ahead and do this. Because if you're the Twins and you're left with a Joe Mauer contract and now he's a first baseman, if you're the Reds and you have Joey Votto, when you're a rebuilding team, and that's a lot of money for a player who's essentially going to be playing on a fourth or fifth place team for the next couple of years, then that contract could be put to other uses in theory. But I wonder if for the Blue Jays, it's easier now that they are raising payroll above $100 million to conceive of a contract for someone like Jose Bautista.
No question it should be. And there certainly is a difference between the high revenue and low revenue teams and their ability to absorb this kind of deal. I don't know that there's any doubt about that. I was going to make one other point about the humanity part and taking that into effect or into account with the game. It actually goes to a column I wrote today. I wrote about Gene Segura, who was just traded from the Brewers to the Diamondbacks, perhaps the worst offensive player in the game the last 2.5 years. And people are, again, asking with the Diamondbacks, what the heck are they doing? Well, last couple of days, I started hearing some things, and we knew about the loss of his infant son at 14, and obviously it's a terrible tragedy. But he also had a contract issue with them. And basically, the start of 14, now he had a bad second half in 13, but before 14, in spring training, it's offered a deal, 40 million, 7 years. And that's a good offer, no question. He had a full year of service at that time, that's not much. And to get a $40 million offer is pretty good. But Simmons had just gotten $58 million from the Braves. And while Simmons is a better player, in Segura's mind, he wasn't $18 million better. And this bothered Segura, and it affected him. And I had Ron Renicki, the former manager, kind of tell me this, and others told me this as well. And I don't know if it accounts for his 2015 season, which was also lousy, but by then he was feeling pressure from that top prospect, Arcia. He knew Arcia was coming, knew he might be on the way out. My point is, all of these things can affect a player. You may argue that, well, he shouldn't worry at all, and he's the idiot who turned down $40 million. Okay, but the players see this relative to their peers. That's how they measure themselves. They see it as a way or a measure of how teams appreciate them. And, again, there's more to it than his 2.5 years of a 600 OPS. Now, maybe he bounces back, maybe he doesn't. And maybe this is the true guy and all of this stuff is irrelevant. But we've seen it before, right? Where things happen in guys' lives or whatever the case might be, injuries, whatever, that affect things, and you don't necessarily understand that from seeing the numbers.
That, to me, gets at something that you wrote in your column that I found really interesting, and something that I truly believe that oftentimes, you know, in mainstream and blog media and all kinds of baseball media coverage, the players' aspect and the players' point of view and perspective and what these guys go through isn't always reflected enough. And you wrote in your column, you said, executives talk about maximizing value, operating with efficiency, replacing older, expensive talent with more affordable youngsters. Writers like me speak the same language, trying to explain how teams think. Now, do you feel that media, and I think we're all guilty of this, too often kind of present the team's case or the front office's case, and not enough kind of the player's point of view?
I don't know that I would say quite like that, but I do think we're guilty of getting too caught up with the analysis right now. Now, certainly there's a segment of the media, that's what they do, right? Fangraphs, Prospectus, That's how they analyze and write about baseball. That's good. And it's all relevant, and it's all welcome, right? But at the same time, I think for people who are in the clubhouses, like me and you guys, and people who are more involved in what is called traditional media, it is our job to explain that it isn't just numbers, it's this, this, and this too, and to give maybe a fuller perspective, if that's possible. Now, obviously we don't know everything, it's not always possible, and people can debate all of these things and the merits of them, that's fair, but I find that with some younger writers, not all, but some, they're falling too easily in this trap. I'm talking about newspaper writers now, newspaper writers, guys coming up on beats. They fall too easily into the trap of the numbers. And it's not that they're explaining the team perspective. It's just that in some ways, crunching those numbers is easier than talking to the players.
Right.
Guess what? That's not what we're supposed to do. We're reporters. And I feel that that's a really important thing. It's actually more important now than ever, in my view, because there's so much available with the numbers and so many people writing that way.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. I think that a lot of how this discussion has evolved so far is really focused on teams and players and their relationships. But you know, I'm wondering, Ken, in tracking the industry so closely as you do, do you ever see that between teams? I mean, a team that's insistent on winning a trade, a team that needs to come out ahead in the value equation, as opposed to finding a win-win trade, maybe like that Drew Storm for Ben Revere trade, where they're two totally different types of player and no one necessarily needs to come ahead as the winner.
There are definitely teams that try to win every trade and are out for any edge they can get that way. And I would imagine that's always been the case, even before analytics, right? There were certain GMs who were out for blood and certain GMs who you could deal with easier. That's a common complaint you hear. I've heard it over the years about certain guys that they're hard to deal with. But at the same time, all the information makes it more difficult, I would think, to win a trade. Everybody has essentially the same information. They have different ways of looking at it. They have their proprietary stuff. But I don't know that the Tampa Bay Rays, Cleveland Indians, and Oakland Athletics, three data-inclined teams, look at things a whole lot differently. They're pretty similar in their approaches. And you can add the Dodgers and many others on that list. So while teams seek to do that and seek to win at all costs in the trade market, I don't know that it's happening very often. That's why the Diamondbacks are so interesting, because they are a team that values players differently than everyone else in the industry. They right. have a different look, a different outlook. And people make fun of them because they're not following the norm right now. Well, they've got a pretty good team. We'll see how they do this year. We'll see if these trades backfire with all the top prospects going away. But, again, we don't know yet, and we're just guessing until we see it all play out on the field.
That's interesting because, you know, and that kind of reflects how I feel like there's a segment of kind of probably younger fans who are very much rooting for their teams to win every trade and to win it in terms of numbers and to be, you know, the most efficient team and to be, you know, the most value hoarding team and this and that. And it kind of, you know, I feel like a fan voice that isn't so much represented and one that came through Pitch Talks and came through in your column is the one that says, well, you know, Jose Bautista has been with the Blue Jays for, you know, 8 seasons now. It's been, he's probably, you know, he's easily one of the best hitters in Blue Jays history. I kind of want to see him retire as a Blue Jay. I want to cheer for my favorite player on my favorite team.
Right. And today, that notion among teams is almost lost. You very rarely hear teams eager to embrace that logic. Now, the Yankees did it with Jeter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they kept him around when they probably didn't want to. But it's just not often that you see teams value that anymore. And again, there is value to it, not necessarily in sheer performance on the field, but marketing, entertainment, all of those things, which, by the way, this is what this industry is, an entertainment industry. Now, you want to win. That's the best form of entertainment. But you can do that, I would think, even if Jose Bautista at age 38 was on your roster.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. And as we talk about this roster, Ken, I'd love to get your take on where exactly the Blue Jays stand entering this 2016 season. The Red Sox are a good team. The Yankees could be a good team. And of course, the Rays and Orioles can't be forgotten about either. Where do you see the Blue Jays as they set out to begin spring training a couple of weeks from now?
They're okay. They're ideally one ace short, which is where they were at the deadline last year. But their depth in the rotation is decent, and they acquired Happ and Estrada without completely extending themselves. Their offense, again, should be one of the best in the game. And obviously, the Revere for Storen trade helped shore up their bullpen and create some options with Sanchez. I really like that trade for both, actually. So I see them being quite competitive, and the fact that they've won but didn't quite get there last year in terms of the World Series championship, that will be a motivator, I would expect, and I would think that this will be a good year for them. Now, clearly things can go wrong, and clearly at the deadline last year, when they weren't a much different-looking team than they were right now, outside of Tulowitzki, they were not that good a team. But I expect with Stroman back now, with Sanchez a year under his belt somewhat, they're going to be okay. How okay, I don't know. Now, you have to look at the rest of the division, too. The Yankees are one question after another in their rotation. The Red Sox, very talented, no question, but let's see it. We all thought they were going to be great last year. I just see the Jays as being competitive for a playoff spot. I don't know exactly how it's going to fit and how it's going to work, and I don't know if they'll be, well, I know they won't be nearly as aggressive at the deadline as they were last year. They don't have the pieces at this point that they did then, but I expect them to be in this mix.
This offseason, the Blue Jays kind of got their heavy lifting out of the way early. You know, Marco Estrada, you know, 2 years, 26, Jay Happ at 3 years, 36. I mean, those are, you know, they brought in Jesse Chavez and then Storen came later. But, you know, when you looked at kind of the Estrada and the Happ deals early on in free agency, I wonder if, you know, did, as you saw the market play out over the rest of the winter, did your view on those deals change at all? I mean, how did that kind of evolve for you?
Well, you're right. And in retrospect, those deals look better every day.
Yeah.
Because money got out of sight. Now, the question's going to be, okay, financially they made smart moves, but are these pitchers good enough? Will Estrada do that again? Will Happ be what he was in Pittsburgh, which is the reclamation home for pitchers? Will he sustain that now that he is out of there? We don't know. If it proves that they're competent to above-average major league starters, it's a win for the Jays. If not, then clearly they've got a problem with Dickey being 41 now, and you don't know exactly where everybody else is. At the same time, is it a better move for them long-term? Probably is. Now, would they have liked, or ideally, would you rather see them have David Price? Yes, it was just never going to happen.
Makes sense. Last one before we let you go, Ken. I wanted to ask about the qualifying offer because it is such a topic of interest these days, and you can look at it in a lot of different ways. One suggestion that I've heard and that you mentioned on Friday at Pitch Talks was the notion that teams could still obtain a draft pick for losing a player, but teams wouldn't have to surrender a draft pick when they sign a player. Do you think that's right. The sort of thing that could gain traction, or do you think that owners might prefer to have a team surrender a draft pick as a way of essentially taxing some middle-tier free agents?
Right, and it's interesting, the whole argument, because a couple of days after I got home from Toronto, I had a talk with a GM who mentioned that idea, that the signing team doesn't lose one, but the team that loses the player gains one. And I said, yeah, but the owners will never go for that because they want the drag on salaries, the tax that you just mentioned. And he said, come on, it's no drag on salaries. That's not happening. The elite guys are still getting their money. Are you dragging the salaries of the four guys this year, Kendrick, Gallardo, Desmond, and Fowler? Great. You know, what does that accomplish? This is the GM saying this. So I can see that being a logical solution. It certainly is a logical solution. Of course, the owners would want something back because they'd be giving something up there.
Right.
And that's what collective bargaining is. It's this massive give and take. I do believe that it needs to be changed, and I know fans say, well, Kendrick should have taken the qualifying offer. It's his fault. At the time he became a free agent, no one was really saying that. Everyone thought there'd be a market for him. And it just seems that there's a certain group of free agents that every year get caught in this vortex with the qualifying offer, and it's not right. These guys have their service time. They qualify for free agency. They're, at least the guys remaining, as long with Kendrick, are good players. They deserve better. And it's maybe not a major issue since it's really only affecting four guys or five guys a year, but I would expect that in the collective bargaining agreement, the next one, it will be resolved.
Yeah, and we could have seen that, you know, even more Kendrick situations if, you know, a Cole Erasmus hadn't accepted or, Matt Wieters or someone in there.
They were wise to accept, obviously.
Yeah.
But, again, for Desmond, there's no way he was accepting, and no way he should have accepted. Fowler was a little bit different, but even Dexter Fowler playing for the Cubs, he had a really good year. You would have thought he'd be okay, but he's not okay.
Very interesting stuff. Ken, we thank you for joining us, and we thank you for giving us something to talk about all week here in Toronto.
Well, thanks, Mutual, guys. Thank you.
Great pitch by Storen, the change. I mean, that thing just diving. Wow, 93, nasty, running, sinking at the last moment, and a couple of Ks for Storen.
It continues on At The Letters, Arden Zwelling with Ben Nicholson-Smith on Sportsnet.ca and on iTunes. Pleased to be joined by one of the newest Toronto Blue Jays, Drew Storen. Drew, what's going on?
Not a whole lot. Thanks for having me, guys.
Good to talk to you, man. Welcome to Toronto. And I guess, you know, I wanted to start with this because one of my favorite stories about you is how you set up kind of in the Nationals bullpen. You built this, like, or at least designed this, like, set of stairs. You made these improvements. You put in this new phone, really putting that Stanford education to good use. Just tell us a bit about that, and if you've had a chance to look at the Rogers Center and maybe do up some blueprints, some mock-ups for how you'd like to improve the Rogers Center bullpen.
Yeah, you know, you spend enough time in that bullpen, you kind of get bored and, you know, figure out ways for a little home improvement. So kind of like, I guess, Toronto actually has elevated seating bullpen, but we didn't have it in D.C., so I kind of drew up a way to do it and then ended up getting that built. It took a little while to get done, but got it done. And then this year on eBay, found a payphone cover, old one, and I bought that, put it in, because I was joking that they should use the bullpen phone as a payphone and let us keep the money. So, you know, just a couple improvements to the bullpen, you know, spice things up down there, because it can, you know, like I said, we spend a lot of time down there, so you got to spruce it up a little bit.
Nice. Well, I think that they're looking for some broader improvements to the Rogers Center as a whole. So if you want to branch out from the bullpen, I'm sure Mark Shapiro would welcome your input.
Yeah. I definitely know a lot more than anybody that really ask, you know, with half the education that I don't have much experience, but hey, you know, why not? I'll give them any advice they want, right?
Yeah, for sure. So with spring training up in a couple weeks, and now it's been a few weeks since you were officially traded to the Blue Jays, what's that period been like, and what are you doing in those last couple of weeks leading up to spring training?
Yeah, you know, a lot of it's just kind of, you know, piecing everything together here and finishing up all my training. And tell you what, it goes by fast. It's amazing how quick 4 months can go. And, you know, it's a combination now of training / packing and moving. So that's usually, you know, the hardest challenge this time of year is packing everything up because, you know, it's one of the three or four times a year you move, and you never realize how much stuff you have until you have to move it all.
I think every player kind of reacts to being traded different, especially their first time. I'm just curious, just with your situation in Washington and everything that's happened in your career, now that you kind of look back on how everything played out with the trade to Toronto, how do you feel about how it went down?
Yeah, you know, I was obviously excited to, you know, get a new opportunity, and especially going to a team like Toronto that's been extremely good and had the run last year that they did, and, you know, in a place that they needed some help. So it's a great fit for me, and that was the number one thing. You know, I had a great time in D.C. You know, they gave me my opportunity, and, you know, I was able to kind of establish myself, and I learned a lot. But now I'm excited for the new challenge of the AL East.
It's funny, when you look back at your time in Washington, you're there for 6 years, which is a pretty long period of time, but you saw so many different things happen. I mean, when you first got there, the Nationals were kind of in that post-Expos era. They still were not a good team or anything close to it. Then a couple years in, you're winning 98 games in the division series, another playoff appearance a couple years after that, and last year was a big disappointment for the Nationals. What was that whole experience like, going from basically one of the lesser teams in the National League to one of the elites?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I've seen a lot. Like you said, I've been on a team with no expectations that, you know, surprised a lot of people, and then I've been on teams where we had a lot of expectations that disappointed a lot of people. So, you know, you know, part of that experience that you really can't, that's something you can't teach, you can't learn from anybody unless you go through it. So for me, that's kind of priceless education, and I think that's, you know, really going to help me, you know, in Toronto, just because, like I said, I've been used to different teams, different teammates, you know, different expectations. But, you know, it's fun to play for a winning team, obviously, and to have the city of D.C. behind it was great, but I'm really excited for Toronto because I've only heard great things about the city and even better things about the fans.
And you know, you served a lot of roles in that Washington bullpen. I mean, you know, you closed, you set up. I mean, you pitched in a lot of different innings. And, you know, I think that every reliever appreciates knowing what their role is and appreciates knowing when they might be called and when they might be coming into the game. There's also a school of thought that, you know, some of the toughest or highest leverage situations can come perhaps earlier, you know, in a game, maybe in the sixth or seventh inning when there's runners on, things like that. I mean, where do you kind of fall in, you know, what situations you like to enter and what you like to see?
You know, I like to, honestly, I see myself as pretty versatile. You know, like you said, I've kind of done it all. It's just a matter, I think, you know, when you set up, you're going to tend to be in more games. So, you know, sometimes you run into the physical side of things that you get used a lot more. But like you said, sometimes that save doesn't always come in the ninth. So I'm of the old school kind of thought where, you know, you kind of try to keep guys in certain roles. And, you know, because you got to look at it from, you know, 162 games perspective and thinking, okay, if you start messing with guys and having guys stretched out early on in the season, it can come back to bite you, you know, in September, and then obviously when the games really matter if you're playing in October.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about was the idea of team chemistry, and it's something that came up a lot here in Toronto last year, people pointed to Russell Martin and Josh Donaldson and said, wow, this is Jose Bautista. They said this is a really good group that seemed to click. And from the outside looking in, it seemed like the Nationals last year might not have had the greatest chemistry, but certainly in years past that would have been different. So what's been your experience with that? Do you find that team chemistry can have an impact on team performance, or is it a byproduct of winning and losing? Where do you stand on that from your experience?
Yeah, you know, it is part of a byproduct. You know, obviously they always say winning, you know, solves everything. But, you know, that team chemistry does get tested throughout the year. And I really think among elite teams, that team chemistry is the difference maker. If you have guys playing for the right reason, you know, willing to move a runner over or, you know, do whatever for the team, then that pays off in the long run. That's the special thing about baseball. That's why you see so much parity in it, because it's not like basketball or something where you can essentially buy a good team. It's not about paying really good players a bunch of money. It's about having a good group of guys that are going to play for the right reasons and, you know, understand that there's a bigger purpose.
Yeah, the Blue Jays are, you know, yeah, it's a team that obviously had great chemistry last year, and guys talked about it, you know, up and down, and they've mostly kept kind of that core intact. There's not been a ton of change to the team coming into 2016. I'm curious, if do you know anybody who's on the team? Do you have any experience with any of these guys, or are you coming in with pretty much a clean slate?
Pretty much clean slate. I knew Marco a little bit, because right when I got drafted, he was with the Nationals, and so I've known him through the years, but that's really about it. So it's going to be, you know, I'll be the new kid in school, I guess, but I'm excited to meet the guys. And I've heard nothing but great things, and talking with guys who've been there and guys that are there now, they all have nothing but great things to say about the guys.
Hey, you mentioned parity before, and I think that's an interesting difference right now between the National League and the American League, because in the NL, you have teams like the Braves and Phillies and Brewers and Reds, and you know, with respect to those teams, it doesn't look like they'll be very good next year. And in the American League, you know, you look around, there aren't any teams, at least as far as I can tell, that are really obvious bottom of the division type clubs. So do you expect that to be a difference on a day-to-day level going through the American League?
I think so. I mean, it's such a different game in general. And, you know, I've gotten a limited taste of it through interleague play. It's such a different game having the DH involved, just because by the time I come into a game, you have at least one bench guy in there. You know, and hitting for the pitcher or whatnot, and if the pitcher was knocked out early, you're looking at a completely different lineup. So it's going to be a new challenge for me anyways. But, yeah, you're right. All the AL teams are pretty stacked, where you have some teams in the NL that are rebuilding. And, you know, kind of like we had to take it under the chin there for a couple years in D.C. in order to get us where we wanted to be. So, you know, it is a little bit different. It's going to be very interesting, especially in the AL East. I mean, you're talking heavy hitters all around.
When you kind of look at how you had success last year, I mean, the strikeout numbers really went up quite a bit. You know, and it's interesting coming to Rogers Center, which is kind of, you know, a place where, you know, some pitchers come in and kind of have to adjust their approach a little bit, just because, you know, it pitches up in the zone tend to, you know, they don't come back. And, you know, with some of, you know, your stuff, you've got kind of the two seamer and you've got the change up and, you know, you've got that fastball with late life. I mean, will you change your approach at all in terms of, you know, pitching down in the zone or working with the sinker a bit more, trying to use that kind of slow Rogers Center turf?
Yeah, you know, I don't anticipate myself changing too much, because I try to be down the zone anyway. I think last year the strikeout numbers, you know, when I first came off, I really tried to be a strikeout guy, and I found that I'd end up hanging more pitches by doing that. And then when you pitch to contact, you end up running into strikeouts. So you combine that with, like, you know, I started throwing a little four-seam cutter last year to mix in against my sinker, and then with my changeup too, just kind of put a lot of pitches in the back of hitters' heads. So, you know, you're used to seeing a sinker slider guy out of the pen. So you got a changeup and something that might cut. You know, you just talk about learning to pitch, which, you know, as many times as I've seen guys now, you know, I've seen guys 15 times deep, you're not surprising with anything. So you really got to learn to pitch a little bit.
Your new teammates in Toronto include a couple of the best right-handed hitters in baseball. But I'm interested to ask about one of the best left-handed hitters and arguably the best left-handed hitter in baseball, Bryce Harper. What was it like watching him last year? I mean, 42 homers, 460 on base percentage, at least watching him on the highlights and to the extent that we see what Bryce Harper was doing up here, it seemed pretty phenomenal, but you got an up-close view.
Yeah, it really was. And I think part of, you know, one of the most impressive things about him is probably something you didn't see on the highlights, and that was his ability to just take a walk. You know, guys, if pitchers, you know, weren't going to give in to him, he wasn't going to just try to force something. So he'd take the walk, and, you know, keep a rally going instead of trying to be a hero and swing at a bad pitch. But he also had the ability, you know, I'll never forget, he took a fastball right down the middle in New York last year, and, the guys on TV were like, what's he doing? And then Addison Reed threw a slider and he hit it to the third deck. So his ability to just kind of sit on a pitch and look for it and go triple deck on it is pretty unbelievable. And then his ability to just kind of flip it the other way and end up going out of the ballpark is pretty incredible. He's only getting better. That's the scary part.
This is obviously going to be an important season for you, just with, you know, you being due to be a free agent at the end of the year. And, you know, I mean, just when you kind of look at how this offseason's played out for, you know, relievers, when you see, you know, how Darren O'Day has done and Ryan Madsen, Joachim Soria, just some of these guys who've, you know, gotten a lot of money through free agency as relievers. For you, I mean, is it about time that relievers started getting paid?
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of see the trend the last couple of years, because you're seeing teams kind of go away from just paying the closer all the money and, you know, kind of filling in everywhere else. You know, I think the bullpen roles, like you said, there are more credits given to the setup guys now, and, you know, that's the way it should be, especially guys, too, that are able to come in at a two-run deficit and hold it there, or can eat four or five innings. You know, those guys are just as important in a bullpen. So, you know, I think you're going to start seeing money spread out a little bit more throughout the bullpen, because, you know, starters aren't going very deep in the game, especially in the NL when you got to, you know, hit for the pitcher. Makes your bullpen that much more important.
Are you a DH guy? Like, I know, obviously, as a relief pitcher, you probably wouldn't end up hitting often, if at all. But in theory, do you like the idea of having the DH, or are you one of those people who's in favor of potentially evening it out between the two leagues and having a DH in both of them?
I enjoy the difference in the game, honestly. I think it's great. I'm somebody that I wish I was a starting pitcher just so I could hit when I was in the NL. I've only got two ABs in my career, but I love to hit. So I like that aspect. I like the idea of pitchers going up and competing. And I also, like I said, I like the difference in the way the leagues are. I would parallel loosely with, like, NCAA basketball and NBA basketball, you know, like more defense oriented in the NL, and, you know, the AL kind of more of an NBA, just offense powerhouse type league.
You mentioned missing being a starting pitcher to hit, but I mean, you were, you know, a guy who came out, you know, in the first round of the draft, and everybody kind of looked at you as a reliever, but, you know, you started in high school, and I you know, and from what I've read, I mean, you didn't start in college just because the opportunity wasn't there. Do you ever miss it?
No, not really. Ever since I kind of went to the bullpen in college and I got that taste of the adrenaline, I kind of knew it was for me. That's what I was built for. So, you know, I told teams I'd start when I got drafted, and I was open to it. But, you know, the Nationals wanted me to stay in the bullpen, and I was fine with that because I knew how much fun it is. You know, I don't know if I have the patience to wait around 5 days if things don't go well.
That's interesting, because most guys, you know, would look at you as a guy with, you know, four good pitches, good command, you know, a good mentality. And most guys would say, you know, that's a starter. And I feel like most players would say, I want to be a starter, but you kind of go the other way.
Yeah. It's funny, because I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I haven't since high school. And, you know, like I said, I didn't have four pitches coming up, so I don't know if I would have had the ability to make it. I'm sure I would have learned to pitch eventually, but, yeah, I definitely think I have a better chance of starting now than I do in, you know, when I first came up. But, you know, like I said, I enjoy it. I really enjoy the back end of the game, and I want to be the guy that's out there to be the hero or the zero, one way or the other.
When you talk about that mentality and that mindset and kind of, you know, being aggressive and the, you know, throwing strikes and the, you know, the adrenaline that goes, I mean, what's your mental routine when you take the mound? What runs through your head?
You just got to simplify things. You know, it's easier said than done. And, you know, it's every cliche possible, right? You just have to go out. Really, the game is only as big as you make it in your head. So, you know, I always say it's like the Hoosiers parallel, right, where they go measure the height of the basket. It doesn't change, you know, no matter what the situation is, you need to get the guy out. Sometimes you got to miss a bat, so it's going to change your approach a little bit. But, you know, it's easy to block out the crowd when they're all really loud and all that. I always joke that it's harder when it's the small crowds and you can hear everything.
We'll finish with this. What's the biggest thing that you're looking forward to about being a Toronto Blue Jay?
Seeing Canada. I've never really been, so that's going to be something new for me. And I've already gotten a good reception by the fans, so I'm excited to see the new fan base. And I don't know, like I said, I feel like a new kid at school, so I'm pretty excited.
Awesome. Well, hey, we wish you the best of luck. We'll be seeing you in Dunedin, and you know, we hope all that packing and everything goes well, and that, you know, you have a good spring.
Thanks, Drew.
I appreciate it. Yeah, if you guys want to stop in Indy and help me pack to get down to Dunedin, let me know.
We'll let you know.
We'll settle on seeing you there. How about that?
All right, there you go. Sounds good.
All right, thanks, man. Drew Storen. Sounds like he's pretty happy to be out of Washington.
Yeah, I think too. I mean, you know what? If you're going to join any team, probably joining the Toronto Blue Jays is now an appealing place to be.
I think things kind of came to a head with him there in Washington a little bit last year.
Right. And yeah. He said nothing but the right things on that front. But I mean, mm-hmm. I think the image of Jonathan Papelbon choking Bryce Harper tells us that things weren't so rosy in Washington.
Yeah. I mean, and Drew Storen was the closer there up until, you know, they traded for Jonathan Papelbon. And, you know, that's, you know, not the first time that he had been usurped from that role. And, you know, I don't know if he's necessarily treated as well as he would like to be there. I mean, some guy, it's funny because you hear, you know, you talk to Josh Donaldson, you know, last offseason. Oh, I'm shocked that the Oakland Athletics traded me. I came out of left field. Troy Tulowitzki, I couldn't believe it. I was, you know, blown away. Drew Storen, yeah, it's pretty happy.
Yeah, I don't think he was shocked. I don't think he was shocked. And, you know, clearly the Nationals knew that it was probably for the best. And they get a good player back in Ben Revere and someone who can play basically every day for them.
Interesting to hear him too talk about, you know, bullpen roles and, you know, kind of being old school about it and, you know, not, you know, liking to know when he's coming into games, not wanting to have, you know, the workload get, you know, too high and not, you know, wanting to be overextended and kind of liking to stay within himself. I mean, as the, you know, as spring training, you know, carries out and players fall into certain roles, I mean, you know, we might see, you know, from the beginning of the season, John Gibbons try to kind of establish guys in those roles and leave them there.
Right. And I won't be surprised if Storen ends up being the capital C closer. You know, I really won't. But it, you know, it's funny too, because as much as we like to think we have the whole bullpen nailed down right now and we can lay out those seven names and know exactly who's going to be where, it's so much in flux once things actually get started.
Yeah, we don't know. But I feel like the back end of the bullpen, we can be pretty sure of, you know, Cecil Osuna, Storen, Sanchez, if he's in the rotation or not, will be there or not. I feel like that's going to be kind of your core group.
Right. But even Sanchez right there. I mean, we're not sure if he's even going to be in that core group. So there's still a lot of decisions to be made.
Of course. We thank you for coming along with us on ATL. You can get us on Twitter. I'm at Arden Zwelling. Ben's at B. Nicholson Smith. Our producer, Sam McKee, changed his Twitter name, which I've said wrong last time. So I'm going to get it right this time as I quickly look it up on my...
Sam A. McKee.
There you go. What? Taking out the Alton? Rebranding yourself?
New year. It's a new season.
It's a new year. It's a new Sam. Yeah, just like the Leafs, he says in my ear. So yeah, hey, thanks for coming along. You know, keep you know, reading sportsnet.ca. Spring training right around the corner. We will obviously have that well covered. You know, Shy, Ben, myself, Blair's gonna be down there, Wilner, you know, all your favorites, the whole bunch.
favorites might be overstating it, but we'll be there. We'll be tweeting.
We will definitely be. And you know, our thanks to Drew Storen for coming along. Our thanks to Ken Rosenthal for you know, a very you know, interesting discussion and everything. And hopefully we can move on from, you know, talking about you know, these maybe we can talk about actual the game of baseball soon.
Something tells me we will do just that before too long.
That's what I've been craving. It's just like a game. Like I miss people being upset that like Troy Tulowitzki went 0-for-4, you know, like
why didn't they pitch him for smoke the seventh inning?
You know, yeah, exactly. Oh my God. I can't believe he left Loop in there. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Kind of missing that a little bit. But then when that comes back, I'll just complain about that. So
it's a cycle.
It's life. This is a cycle of complaints. Anyway, for Sam, for Ben, I'm Arden. Thanks for coming along with us on At the Letters.